State lawmakers have agreed to return to Tallahassee on June 1st for a special session. The session ended early after the House and Senate were unable to agree on health care spending. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. Florida's current $77 billion budget expires on June 30th. The House and Senate were about $4 billion apart with their proposed spending plans for the upcoming fiscal year. The Senate was counting on drawing down federal money to fund a version of Medicaid expansion. The House and Governor Scott were and are against that idea. House Speaker Steve Crisafulli abruptly ended the session 3 days early. There's also the uncertainty over federal funding of the low-income pool. Dr. Susan McManus is a political science professor at the University of South Florida, and veteran political reporter William Wendy March covered the session for the Associated Press. Welcome to Florida Matters.
Hey, glad to be here, Carson.
Thank you.
So there are so many moving parts here. Wendy, help me sort through all this. How did the legislature end up getting painted into this corner?
Well, it has to do with an impasse over health care and the budget between the House on one side and the somewhat slightly less conservative Senate on the other side. To get down into the nitty-gritty details of it, the Senate is in favor of expanding health care for low-income people under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The House opposes that. Whether that's done or not affects, of course, how the budget is put together, and the result of this is neither side would give an inch. They arrived at an impasse. And the result was they were unable to agree on a budget.
Now, the Senate plan is not a true Medicaid expansion. It does rely on federal money, but it would go into private plans in Florida. Isn't it sort of a kind of a Medicaid expansion?
It's kind of a Medicaid expansion. It's aimed at helping the same kind of people that straight Medicaid expansion would help. But the Senate partisans of that plan will insist to you that no, it is not Obamacare, and no, it is not Medicaid expansion. It's a program that uses private insurance that people could buy through a state-run exchange, and it has work requirements and requirements for copays and premiums that Medicaid doesn't have.
So the patients would have some skin in the game on that.
That's the idea.
Dr. McManus, how in the world is it that two Republican chambers and a Republican governor, although he's not directly involved in this process, how can they be so far apart on this Medicaid expansion?
Well, let's not forget that the senators represent a lot more people in their districts. There are 40 senators and there are 120 House members. And so the House members tend to represent narrower constituencies, and a lot of them represent more conservative districts. And, of course, they're thinking about reelection, as most politicians do. The senators, on the other hand, represent larger constituencies, more diverse, more in metropolitan areas where there is a higher incidence of poor and people in need of health care. And that's one reason is the difference in the constituency districts. But a second one, let's not forget this as well. When one party controls everything, all of a sudden, factions emerge, and it becomes personality and ambition-driven and ideological. So you get the rural and the urban splits. You get the conservative Republicans and the more moderate Republicans all fighting with each other for their priorities. So it's a little bit of both of those things.
About a month ago, Speaker Crisafulli said that most Floridians don't care for this expansion. They don't want Medicaid expansion. Was he on the mark with that, or is he overstating a resistance to Obamacare in Florida?
Well, Obamacare nationally and in Florida has never had a majority of the electorate say that they support it, but it's been around 50% or so, 52%. The problem is that you can make those claims, but the polls have been all over the map, and the wording that's used can create different results.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And we haven't seen any consistent, clearly worded polling that reflects the choices on the table.
Wendy March, back in the Don Gates, Will Weatherford days, Speaker Weatherford was totally against Medicaid expansion. And so President Don Gates pretty much said, hey, if it's not going to fly in the House, why even bother taking it up in the Senate? Now, this time, the Senate did not capitulate. Why the difference this time?
Well, it's just a matter of the opinions of the president of the Senate, Andy Gardner, and his estimation of the opinions of the members of the Senate and what they ought to do. Late in the session, both sides, both Senate President Andy Gardner and House Speaker Steve Crisafulli, held meetings with their Republican caucus members, who are, of course, the majority in each House, to line their troops up, to whip them into line behind their respective positions. Neither side would give an inch. Now, for the House, that maintains the position that they've had for the past couple of sessions. For the Senate to insist this strongly on the issue is what's new and different. And my suspicion is that you'll see the Senate cave in the special session.
Senate Budget Chief Tom Lee of Brandon, what did you make of him sort of telling the governor to back off on this? The governor, I think, was, at least offering overtures, if not outright telling lawmakers what he wants to happen. And he said, hey, back off. It's not your turn yet.
Well, what the governor has suggested that doesn't make sense in Lee's opinion is what the governor has called a continuation budget. And that's avoiding the impasse and passing a budget that he says would simply continue current funding levels. The problem is that there's no provision for any such thing at the state government level the way there is at the federal level. And the way Lee put it was, that's a made-up word. There's no such thing. The legislature is required by the state constitution to balance a budget, to create a balanced budget, not a continuing resolution of the kind that Congress can pass. And they've got to do that by the end of June. Now, Scott's involvement was on the side of the House. He sides with the House against the Senate on Medicaid expansion. So I think those are probably the reasons for Lee's attitude.
Dr. McManus, back in 2011, the Senate and House approved a plan to privatize Medicaid. What is it about the Senate's plan this year that drives the House so crazy?
Well, it's all about politics, and unfortunately,
it's not about the nuts and bolts.
Well, some of that, but there's leadership tugs of war right now. There's an election coming up next year. Some people are termed out. They're looking at what to run for next. And, leadership struggles are going on within the chambers for people who are next in line to next in line. I think a lot of it is that. But another real burr is this low-income pool that has to do with federal funding as well that's coming in to support some of the same people that would be shifted to other things. And suddenly they're thinking about, we might lose that amount. I think that's the new part of all of it, is they're worried about losing that chunk of federal change in addition to maybe not getting the money to do their own health care plan. I'm speaking of the Senate right now.
Yeah, Governor Scott has been going back and forth with HHS over the low-income pool, LIP, which pays hospitals in Florida to treat low-income and uninsured patients. He says, Governor Scott says, the government is pulling the rug out from under all these uninsured and low-income patients. HHS says Medicaid expansion is a better way to treat these. Now, Wendy Marsh, do LIP and Medicaid do the same thing?
No, they don't do quite the same thing. To backtrack a minute, I want to point out that what Susan just said was right on the point. The involvement of the LIP money this year, the low-income pool money this year, is another new factor that's created the impasse this year that wasn't present when the same disagreement occurred in the last couple of years. What this is it's a $2.2 billion fund. $1.3 billion of that is federal money, and it goes to hospitals that treat people indigent people who can't pay their own bills. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, what this does is, if people don't have Medicaid and can't pay their own bills, this helps cover the hospital's costs. A lot of people would say that that Scott's contention that the feds are pulling the rug out from under the state by discontinuing this program, Scott's critics would say that this is disingenuous because the state has known for at least a year, and everybody else seems to have had a strong suspicion or direct knowledge for even longer than that, a couple or 3 years maybe, that this program was not going to last forever. As of a year ago, it was known that it would end this summer. So when Governor Scott says that the federal government is trying to force the state to expand Medicaid by withdrawing the low-income pool, some people would say his critics would say he's being disingenuous with that. But he is correct to the extent that there is apparently some degree of linkage. The federal government has said they don't want to continue the low-income pool forever, and the Affordable Care Act's answer to helping low-income people get health care is the Medicaid expansion.
Dr. McManus, HHS did say, and I think I read this in the Associated Press, Wendy March, back in April, that LIP would not be extended unless Florida expanded Medicaid.
Well, and now it's become a lawsuit, as you know, and other states have joined in because they see it as coercion, linking the two together and punishing. They don't see that as part of Obamacare. But let me also say that that's another thing about all this. Some people think that this will magically resolve itself or that they can wait until January. Remember, the next regular session is in January as opposed to March. So they're thinking somehow magically things will get resolved. But when you get into the courts, nothing is going to be resolved quickly in a couple months' time. And so I think that that's a little bit unrealistic. But it is true that other states have joined in on the lawsuit claiming that the Affordable Care Act does not allow the joining of the two together.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled on that, said that the federal government may not coerce states. And just on the surface, do Governor Scott and Pam Bondi have a case that this was coercion?
Well, that's the basis of the lawsuit, absolutely. And that's why a couple other states, Kansas and one other state, have joined in on it. So we'll see. But it's really everything is so ironic. You have, you know, Republicans who are suddenly asking for federal money, and all the tables are turned. And the irony of all is that we entered this session this year with broad proclamations about how much money we had to spend this year. And so what we end up in is a crunch because of this big chunk of federal money that may or may not be there, which means that a lot of these people, Republicans, who are normally against taking federal money or whatever, suddenly thinking we need it because if we don't take it, forget the health stuff. It means I'm not going to get XYZ for projects in my district, and I have to go up for election next year.
I want to talk more about that in a moment, but this could leave a big hole in the budget. How will that gap be closed in the special session, considering that money may not be here?
Well, that's a good question, and it goes to the heart of the matter. Before the session started, as Susan just said, it appeared that the state had a big surplus coming, more than $1 billion, I think $1.7 billion.
I think it was even more than that.
The state is not in bad shape.
$1.8 billion, I think, is the right number. No, the state was not in bad shape, and Governor Scott proposed a budget that included large-scale tax cuts, some $700 million worth of tax cuts, in addition to elevating public school funding back to its historically highest level, which occurred in 2007-2008. But he assumed as part of that budget that the LIP funding would continue, even though, as his critics say, he should have known that it would not.
So there's enough blame for everybody in all of this. Well, but meanwhile, the public is very incensed about the inability of the legislature to get something done, which is the one responsibility they have under the Constitution.
Well, Tom Lee in the Senate warned of that early on in the session, the regular session, that, you know, we're not going to count on these tax cuts or the K-12 spending increase because of the possibility that that LIP funding would go away.
Well, the most likely source to fill what is now a budget hole because of the disappearance of LIP money is ending the governor's plan and the plan that was passed by the state house, for those large-scale tax cuts, close to $700 million in tax cuts, and probably failing to elevate public school funding back to those levels that Scott said he wanted.
I want to ask you one question about this hospital commission the governor has created. Administrators at Broward County's Safety Net Hospital say they will take huge losses if the legislature does not expand Medicaid or replace that federal hospital support. Governor Scott has formed this commission to investigate how well or how poorly those hospitals are doing. Is this commission going to find a bunch of hospitals in the state barely hobbling along, or what will this commission find?
I suspect they're going to find some that are hobbling along, and they're going to be the ones in the more rural areas, because rural medicine in this country and rural hospitals are in a bad shape, and we do have some rural parts of our state. That's one issue. But the second is timing. How can this commission, before the budget has to be enacted, which is the end of June, how can they come to conclusions which would allow the legislature to formulate policies that reflect what they find? Now, the governor has several times singled out certain hospitals. He said, show us the bottom line. You're making tons of money. You don't need it. So here again is an irony. Here's a governor that suddenly is looking at means testing, and hospitals are sort of in the crosshairs of this idea. Ideology's gone out the window in a way. Suddenly practicality and money is, you know, pushing people in weird directions ideologically.
All right, question for both of you here. Anyone here believe that the legislature will actually pass a budget during this special session? And you've already alluded to the...
I think they absolutely will, Carson. The alternative is essentially a shutdown of state government. Now, of course, it wouldn't completely shut down, but there would be all sorts of questions about what services continued and what employees would be expendable. But everybody involved, Republican leadership in the House, the Republican leadership in the Senate, and the Republican governor, all of those parties are keenly aware that a government shutdown would be politically disastrous, just as it was for Republicans in what year was it, 2010, 2011, I guess, when it resulted from arguments between the Obama administration and the Republican-dominated House over budgeting. Here, all of the players are Republicans, and they know that failure to do what they're constitutionally required to do, pass a balanced budget, would be a political disaster that heading into an important presidential election.
And a U.S. Senate race. I mean, you've got
US
two.
And
the last three elections in our state have only been decided by 1%. That's how close it is. It is political suicide. I agree with Wendy, if they don't get it done.
We touched on this earlier about what you refer to as the continuing resolution that Congress uses quite often, but I've never heard about it in the state. Governor Scott has called it a bare-bones budget, and some of Scott's key items, like the tax cuts and the school spending, would just all evaporate. Is that right?
Yes. Well, it could. I don't think all of it's going to. I mean, you're into the point right now in budgeting where if you spend less here, I mean, you spend more here, you have to spend less here. And so things are being pushed around. The percentages that will be allocated to different portions will change somewhat. But it's totally a mess. And I also wonder, and maybe Wendy knows the answer to this, if their constitutional duty is to pass a budget, what does that do legally to their stature as a legislator if they have not met their constitutional obligations? At a minimum, it will be a huge incentive for opponents to surface to run against them, and that will be a big part of their campaign.
I want to talk more about what lawmakers did and did not do during this unusual legislative session in just a moment. My guests are Dr. Susan McManus, political science professor at the University of South Florida, and veteran political reporter William Wendy March. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper. We're talking about the recently ended Florida legislative session and the soon-to-convene special session on the budget. Dr. Susan McManus, political science professor at the University of South Florida, and veteran political reporter William Wendy March, who was covering the session for the Associated Press. Dr. McManus, if lawmakers fail to pass this budget, you've suggested that, first of all, you don't think that they're going to fail to pass a budget during the special session, right?
I don't, because I agree with Wendy. The consequences politically are just too high. The question is, will they have worked out a deal before they get there? Mm-hmm. I was recently on a program with former Congressmember Jim Davis, former legislator, and he said, you never go to a special session if you don't have the deal already worked out. So you think that, you know, and several people have said that subsequently. So you have to think that there's a lot going on behind the scenes at this moment.
Wendy March, they set aside 20 days for this special session. Is that a long – that seems like a long time for just a budget. Do you think they'll add other items to the agenda?
It is a long time for just a budget. Whether they add other items to the agenda is a very good question. There are some interest groups that are pushing to have legislation that died in the sudden adjournment because it couldn't be dealt with by both houses, negotiations couldn't be completed, to have that legislation added to what's known as the call for the special session. The way this works is the House and the Senate have to agree on this document called the call, and it specifies what items they can take up, and they can't take up anything that isn't listed. Well, the budget obviously will be the main part of the call. The question is whether any other kinds of legislation gets added to it.
But you can also make the argument that just about everything relates back to the budget in some way if they wanted to. And it would take, an extraordinary majority of each House to bring something new to the session, even while they're in session. It can be done. But what is really interesting is there's a couple big-ticket items besides the health care. A huge one that's very controversial is this whole gambling issue with the Seminole Indian tribe.
That's right. That 5-year compact expires this summer, and is that it for the compact?
Well, that's one of the items that is probably most likely to be added to the call. No one knows whether it will be, and as Susan said, the legislature could add items to the call, but it would take an extraordinary majority in both houses. What's happening is the compact gives the Seminole tribe a monopoly in the state on banked card games, including blackjack. In return, the tribe has paid the state about $1 billion over 5 years. They want to expand their card operations, their card game operations. They're probably willing to pay more money for it. They're willing to invest in new buildings, new jobs, new casinos. But negotiations have failed so far to produce a new compact. If they don't get one, then that leaves the Seminoles on their own, and they have grounds to take various kinds of unilateral actions as a sovereign nation to expand gambling on their own. That would put them in a big fight with the state. Nobody wants the big fight. What everybody wants is to have a nice steady flow of money into state coffers from Seminole gambling under some kind of a new agreement.
Anyone in the mood to give lawmakers credit for actually passing some laws during the session? Growlers are now legal.
It might be easier to talk about what they actually did get passed. It's a shorter list, or it seems like it. In fact, they passed a couple of hundred pieces of legislation and sent them to Scott. Some of the ones that got the most attention were a new one-day waiting period required to get an abortion. As you pointed out, the Growler Bill, and what this does is, it's called the Growler Bill because that refers to a container of beer, a 64-ounce container of beer that you can buy at a craft brewery, or you could buy it in every state except Florida. It's a very popular size to sell craft beer, but it wasn't legal in Florida. Mm-hmm. In Florida, you could sell a full gallon, 128 ounces, or you could sell 32 ounces. But you couldn't sell the popular 64-ounce size that every other state had legalized. Well, there was no really good reason for this, and people on both sides acknowledged that there wasn't, but the growler, in fact, had become a pawn in an argument between the new small craft breweries and the big brewers, such as Anheuser-Busch.
And their distributors.
And their distributors, mm-hmm. over how beer is marketed and sold in Florida. And settling that argument was what it took to legalize the growler.
Now, lawmakers agreed to move the presidential primary up to March 15th so as to play by the rules, so Florida will get all of its delegates next year.
Well, it's about time that both parties in Florida recognize that going early, as much as they in some ways are justified to do so, it costs them delegates to the conventions. We have a history of the Democrats doing it, the Republicans doing it, and each of them getting stripped of delegates over the years. But there's still a lot of sentiment, not only in Florida but elsewhere, against New Hampshire and Iowa going first in this whole process when they are among the least diverse states in the entire U.S. And for to win the nomination, you have to win big, diverse states. And so in that sense, people are sympathetic with the legislators' feelings that, you know, in the past that we should leapfrog ahead and go early to have more of an influence on who gets nominated. But in exchange, we lost delegates. And finally, they've thrown up their hands and said,
"Well, could
we can't fight this, so let's just go by the rules and enhance our delegates."
Could the fact that one and quite possibly two of the Republican candidates will be from Florida, could that have had any effect on the on that move to March 15th?
Well, yeah. Florida it's the third largest state and the third largest cache of delegates to the conventions of any state. And yes, there are two, obviously, Florida favorite sons who will be high in the competition for the nomination, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Two other Floridians also running, Mike Huckabee and Ben Carson. And very high on the lawmakers' minds as they voted on this primary date was making sure that all those delegates that we have to the conventions will go to their to a Florida candidate.
Veteran political reporter William Wendy March, who covered the session for the Associated Press, Dr. Susan McManus, political science professor at the University of South Florida. It is so great to see you both. Thank you for being here.
Enjoyed it, Carson.
Thank you.
As always, we would love to hear from you. Let us know what's on your mind on our Facebook page or by email. Send it to floridamatters@wusf.org. Our show is produced by Lottie Watts, engineer Craig George, and is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.